It's not religion, it's the onset of senility. Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast that's trying to forget about Afghanistan. From 1967 through to its demise in 1994, Cannon Films produced and distributed hundreds of films across a wide range of genres. But what they're most famous for are the action movies they made during the 1980s, when the company was run by the idiosyncratic duo of Menahem Golan and Yoram Globus. Often starring Charles Bronson or Michael Dudikoff, the company enjoyed a period of phenomenal success that fueled the ambitions of its owners. Under the leadership of Golan and Globus, Cannon went from scrappy independent to designs on becoming a major entertainment conglomerate. Unfortunately, those aspirations were undone by a combination of awful artistic choices, bad business decisions, and some questionable accounting. And by the 90s, Cannon were running on fumes. All of which brings us to the film we're reviewing here. Hitting cinemas in February 1993, 50/50 was one of the last films that Cannon ever released to the world. Within a year, Cannon was no more. To help me review the film, I'm joined by a man who has an encyclopedic knowledge of Cannon films. Here to give me chapter and verse on 50/50 is the author of the Cannon Film Guide, Austin Trunick. Welcome to the show, Austin.
Oh, thank you for having me, Will.
No, it's a pleasure to have you here. Pleasure to always have an expert on this podcast. Generally, it's just a couple of amateurs trying to bungle the way through things. So always nice to be working with someone who knows what they're talking about. But as I mentioned, you have written a book, the Cannon Film Guide Volume 1. You still clearly got other volumes to go. So what, though, I wanted to ask you was, what is it about Cannon films that made you want to undertake such a project?
I fell in love with movies in the video store era, where every Friday night I would go with my father in the 80s and we'd rent our weekend's entertainment, and that 15-minute trip where you're looking at every box, you're reading the text on the back, looking at a postage stamp sized picture from the movie to try to decide, this is what I'm dedicating my weekend to. And that is where my love of film began. And years later, I went into writing about film. I've been writing as a freelancer for many years for various outlets. I went to school for film studies and so on. And when it came to a time that I wanted to work on a project on my own, I needed something to really occupy myself and something that would keep my interest for a long period of time. And my brain just kept going back to Cannon and seeing Invasion USA, Revenge of the Ninja, movies like that on the video store shelf, these unforgettable covers that you really, these are movies that are hard to forget, and they lodge themselves in my mind as a child, and as I became an adult, I just kept coming back to them.
So what is it about the 80s output of Cannon that is worthy of being, remembered or documented?
Well, this is a company that I feel confident saying took more chances than any others out there. A lot of it was because they were the way they sold movies. They pre-sold them first, and then once enough buyers, whether distributors in other countries or video or cable, had bought into it, they would send it into production. So in most cases, they were already making a profit on the films before they would even came out in theaters. It didn't matter if people came and saw them. It didn't matter if they got bad reviews, because Cannon had already taken that money and made two more movies with what they made off of the previous one. And they had just this very fast way of working that fascinates me, that they worked with a lot of filmmakers who were either young and hungry and willing to work on Cannon budgets and really squeeze a lot of extra production value out of that. And they had these sort of aging filmmakers, that guys like J. Lee Thompson and Andrew McLaughlin, who hadn't done as much for several decades and were eager to get back into it and kind of get back in the saddle. So I think for any of these low budget companies, and Cannon was not the only low budget, mid budget company of the time, but they really kind of wound up their toys and just let them go, and you have some amazing results because of that. I do think a lot of these movies are better. They're fighting above their weight class. Mm. It's, especially when it came to their action films. They knew where to spend money and make it count, and where you'd see it on screen.
Well, before we get stuck into to 50-50, I wondered if you could set the scene a little bit. So, as I mentioned in my intro, this was among the sort of the last films that Canon ever made. It came out at a time when the company was beset by problems. So I wondered if you could sort of paint us of a picture of where Canon were at this point and how they'd got there.
Well, Canon was in a very dire financial situation for quite a while at this point. They kind of hit their peak as far as their spending power, their ability to attract big name stars in 1986, 1987, and it crashed very suddenly at that point. They had, like you'd mentioned, a lot of bad investments, some very shady way of reporting and saying how much money they'd actually made and how much money they had spent on films, and just some films that were huge flops. And it got to the point where they didn't have the money to make these bigger budget movies that they were attempting to make. You have very famously Superman 4, where the budget got torn apart before they could really get going, and you have Masters Universe, where supposed to be a big action fantasy movie where Canon literally was standing there ready to pull the before it finished. In 88, you have the company's a fellow by the name of Giancarlo Peretti comes in, and very famous, kind of a con man, but he became a movie mogul for a few years. But he bought Canon, he bought later MGM, and really used these movie companies in every way except for actually the purpose of making movies. He had employed his 20-year-old daughter as their chief financial officer. He had, I think, something like five mistresses on the payroll. Just wild stories, wild stories. But in any case, he had bought Canon, and that sort of led to a split between Golan and Globus. Menachem Golan kind of, I think, saw the writing on the wall, kind of got pushed out, but also it's like, not the place I want to be. He split. He went and took over 21st Century Productions and made some great early 90s movies, the Night of the Living Dead remake, and you have the Captain America, the Albert Pune version. And Golan stayed at, or Globus stayed at Canon for a little bit longer, but then when Peretti bought MGM, he became the president of MGM and kind of left Canon on its own. Canon was this, for a little while, this smaller entity that had, of course, dozens of movies in production, dozens of movies that they owed to people, and they just sort of kept going, and they were treading water at that time. So the early 90s is kind of a rough point because they have these movies that they had made and were much lower budget than what you would have seen from stars like Chuck Norris, Charles Bronson, Michael Dudikoff in earlier years. But they had either only sold them in certain countries. They didn't have the money to distribute them themselves. They were having hard times finding distributors. So you have a lot of films that sat from 1990, 91, 92. And finally, by 92, 93, the period we're looking at here, Canon's really just bailing water at that point, trying to stay afloat. They need to get a lot of these movies that they've had sitting, haven't been able to release on shelves into theaters. They're kind of dumping them. If you look at release weekends for a lot of these films, you have several that are released on the same weekend because Canon's literally looking at the calendar being, where can we get these out where they're not going to have, where there's actual screens available and it's not going to take as much effort. But that's where 92, 90, early 93, early 94, you get movies like Hellbound, Rescue Me, Chain of Command, Street Night, American Samurai. 50-50, which had been sitting on Canon shelves, kind of collecting dust for a couple years. And yeah, then after that, 94, it really all fell apart. It just stopped this big flood of movies that Canon had going for 12, 13 years at that point, just came to an end because they ran out of the material that they had been sitting on. And that was it. That's all she wrote.
Okay, well, we're going to. I think it's time we got stuck into this last flowering, or one of the last flowerings of Canon films. So let's have a quick listen to the trailer. So yeah, Trailer Man, take it away.
Jake and Frenchie are friends.
What the hell are you doing here? I heard you were dead.
Do I look dead? No, but you don't smell too good.
in their line of work.
You squirrel brain doofus, you just blew the best gig I ever had.
Hey, I'm sorry. How long are you gonna hold a grudge?
This is no grudge, Bubblehead. It just happened. Next week it'll be a grudge.
The hours are flexible.
Company has a job for you two.
Drop dead.
You can always count on the CIA. They'll always let you down.
The pay is unbeatable.
We believe in the Deutsche Mark, the Swiss franc, the Kruger Rand, the yen.
$250,000 each.
The benefits are incredible.
What the hell are you eating now? Another one of those Bing Bongs?
This is a great survival food. It won't rot in the jungle. Wild animals won't touch it. That's a fact.
Has it occurred to you that maybe they know something you don't?
Just a couple of guys.
I'm afraid I can't let you live.
Oh, I'm not worried. Are you worried?
Looking for a good time.
No, I'm starting to worry. Yeah!
But somehow.
Is there nothing you won't do for a price?
Oh, there's gotta be something.
They became something.
You made this yourself, huh?
Neither was prepared for.
What you're doing here is good.
First time for everything.
Heroes.
I got a plan.
And Robert Hayes.
Yeah.
A full frontal assault is your plan?
Got the element of surprise.
Suicide is always surprising.
Are taking chances.
Would it help if I promise not to try it again?
Which at best.
Go ahead. Shoot them both.
I think you've just been fired.
Are 50-50.
Two friends and soldiers of fortune are recruited by the CIA to lead the overthrow of a power-mad dictator of the fictional island of Tangara. After whipping the local rebels into shape, they're about to launch their coup d'etat when the CIA betrays them and the revolutionary forces they're leading are wiped out. Feeling guilty about what's happened to our heroes, the CIA handler offers to pay off the two bickering buddies, but too much blood has already been shed, and even for these cynical mercenaries, and despite the seemingly impossible odds, the duo decide to see the job through and get rid of the dictator. Now, the film's two leads here are played by RoboCop's Peter Weller and Airplane's Robert Hayes. Alongside them is Charles Martin Smith, who you may remember as the bookish and bespectacled cop helping to take down Al Capone in The Untouchables. Smith is also the film's director. This was one of his first efforts in that field, and that's principally how he continues to work in the film industry today. There are a couple of interesting names as writing credits on this film. So Dennis Chirac and Michael Butler are the screenwriters behind this. They worked quite regularly as a double act and penned screenplays to a couple of Clint Eastwood films, namely Pale Rider and The Gauntlet. They also wrote the Chuck Norris film Code of Silence, and the two men both wrote the rather good underknown Kennedy assassination thriller Flashpoint. Now, it seems the script for this had been floating around Hollywood since the 80s, and at one time or another, it had been considered as a project for Sylvester Stallone, Kurt Russell, Chuck Norris, amongst others. 50-50 has a 5.8 rating on IMDb and a 3 out of 5 rating on Letterboxd. So with all of that out of the way, Austin, what did you make of 50-50?
It's one of these films that I do feel hits a little bit above its weight class. You can tell that they had sort of been written with this probably larger stars in mind, a larger Hollywood budget, and became shrunk down into this lower budget canon picture. You'd mentioned Stallone and Russell. Cannon was they were happy to go through Stallone's, basically the scripts he would toss out. They were known to do that in the past. And I think that's probably how this came through there. They had also were familiar with the writers through Hero and the Terror. And when this project came to them, they had initially seen it as something for Chuck Norris. And this would have been in 1989 when they had gotten a hold of it. And they began advertising it with Chuck Norris, big photo of Chuck Norris, with a bunch of helicopters behind him, some explosions. It's a cover. I'm excited to send
Sounds very exciting, Ned. Yeah.
And that didn't happen. Norris had been hesitant to do the project. He didn't want to do any more jungle projects, and there had been some accidents on the previous ones. So he was kind of looking to get away from these foreign productions where there was really not as much money going into it, not as many safety precautions. So that's when he had started going back more towards cop movies at that point, and soon Walker, Texas Ranger. Very different from the Missing in Action and Delta Force things he'd been doing prior up until this. But back to the film itself, I do think it's very fun. I like Weller. I like Hayes. They're not anybody I'd ever picture in a as making a great sort of buddy pairing, buddy military film. And they do a good job. I think they are fun to see together.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's a very fun film myself. And, you know, it's interesting knowing the history of this project. But even just watching it, I think even if you didn't know that, I think there is this sense of there's an extra sheen of quality to the material here, which isn't necessarily always, isn't always apparent when you're watching a canon film. But, you know, this is, there's some good action here. There's some comedy. There's a dash of romance. You've got a couple of enjoyable characters in Hayes and Weller, you know, fronting this film. And it's only 96 minutes long. There's no real sort of dead spots in it. So, I mean, I'm not saying this is, you know, a top tier, you know, undiscovered classic or anything, but in terms of where this film was sort of budgeted, the stars they've got in it, I agree with you. It definitely punches above its weight, and it's a really sort of good little sort of B movie from that time period.
And there are also those moments, or people who love seeing in these movies where the budget sort of does show through that it is cheaper. There, I just think of when they're infiltrating the enemy base towards the end, and it's very clearly just one plywood box that they had painted and used, and there's a great exploding dummy at the end that's very obvious and a lot of fun to see because they kind of dwell on it longer than the illusion can hold up.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would agree with you. I think the ending is definitely one of the areas where the budget does sort of fail to really help the film and help the filmmakers behind it. Wanted to pick up on one of the things that you'd mentioned, which is the two stars of this movie, because I think at the heart of this film, really what engaged me the most was the relationship between, you know, Robert Hayes and Peter Weller. And it feels very much like a film that sort of falls into that sort of category of buddy-buddy film. So I wondered if you could, yeah, did you enjoy their relationship as much as I did?
I was really impressed, I think, watching this in Robert Hayes, because my impression of him is Airplane. That's the first thing that comes to mind. And he has a character who is the comic foil of the two guys here, but he does a great job, and is sort of this action character too. And he's somebody who was the biggest surprise. And Weller, of course, is wonderful, but their chemistry is what makes this work. And as much as I like looking at, say, the Chuck Norris version of the poster, the canon mocked up, I'm very glad that this kind of fell into the hands of actors with a bit more natural charisma and chemistry. It kind of gives me, I think, back to something like Firewalker, which was Lou Gossett Jr. and Chuck Norris, sort of a buddy adventure film. They were two soldiers of fortune in a similar way. And I compare it and I'm just like, ooh boy, it's, I think we dodged a bullet and got the better casting here.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think, you know, Weller and Hayes have a really nice rapport, like, on screen together. They have a very easy chemistry, and they really sell the idea that these are two characters who've been through the wars together, and, you know, who know each other inside and out. And Weller, as you were sort of alluding to, you know, Weller is kind of the straight man in this partnership. He's the sort of the perhaps the brains of the operation. He's the one who has to sort of come up with the plans to get them out of the scrapes that they get themselves into. Whereas Hayes is more of the wise ass, you've got a sort of sarcastic sense of humor, a bit more of a sort of impulsive character. But the rat-a-tat-tat of the dialogue between them, the kind of the interplay between them, there's quite a few scenes where it's just them on their own, I don't know, sitting around a campfire in the jungle or traipsing through some hills and stuff. And there, you know, there's nothing really sort of going on in those moments. It's just them two relating to each other. And they're actually really engaging scenes. They're not sort of stuff you're just like, okay, when are we going to get to the next explosion? They're actually, you know, amongst the better bits of the movie.
And that's, I think, speaks to the quality of the screenplay here. That's what I think is the reason why somebody like Stallone and Kurt Russell would have actually given it consideration. They ultimately did Tango and Cash instead, which was the better choice for their careers, I'm sure. But yeah, there's there's some great, the characters themselves, even taking the actors out of them, are written in a way that's fun. You get to like these two, and I think it helps you buy into the far-fetched parts of the story, because you like these two and you think they would do these things for each other and kind of have each other's backs in ways that, if it were a lesser script, it would have been a hard buy.
I mean, I would agree with you. I definitely think that this is a good script by and large. There was an element within it, though, that I did find a little bit disappointing, which is, you know, they've got this bickering relationship and, you know, there's quite a lot of backwards and forwards banter between them. But there are some very strange insults that the two of them throw at each other. So I think, you know, at various points, they're calling each other bird brain, brick brain, bubblehead, squirrel brain, cheese face, and those lines just sort of really jarred, unfortunately, with me. And I don't know what happened there, whether there was a lack of inspiration on the part of the script writers, or whether there was some sort of last minute rewriting because they wanted to keep the language a bit cleaner to go for a different rating. But I don't know if that was something that you picked up on as well.
It is goofy, and I wonder, I wish I had a script for this to just know whether that was something that was just a kind of silly insults on behalf of the writers, or if those were things that Hayes and Weller just took from the scripts and said verbatim. I feel like if those were in the script, somebody would have been like, we can come up with something better on the spot, something funnier to say right here, or just more natural. Because those are kind of odd school playground bully type names that they use for each other.
Yeah, it's definitely an odd point. But kind of continuing on the relationship between these two characters, I mean, there's a pivotal plot moment within this film, which, you know, hinges on the fact that these up till then fairly cynical mercenaries suddenly abandon their own self interest and take up the fight on behalf of the rebels. And, you know, this is a point of film where they could, you know, walk away and be handsomely paid, you know, for doing that. But they decide to stay. Now, I'll put my cards on the table. I kind of found that the weakest part of the film. It doesn't hugely, I can kind of get over it. It doesn't ruin the film for me. But I did find myself a little bit frustrated by that point of the film.
I would agree with that. Again, the way the thing that happens that kind of spurs that change of attitude is, I think, done in. It came as a surprising. It's a kind of a shocking moment, something you don't expect, because what's leading up to that point, you kind of feels very predictable and hokey. And I think that's a nice sort of pivot to throw people off. But as far as, there's so many points where throughout the film, I'm like, they could just stop right now. They could go home. They don't need to do this. Why are they sticking through it? And again, they might have been able to fix that had they told us more about what happened in their prior in Afghanistan, as you alluded to earlier, that a lot of their attitude is as far as it's like, never again, we can't, you know, this, we need to actually we can't just walk away. Like we can't let these things keep happening. We need to take action. And it is a hard sell, but they need a reason to keep them there. Yeah. They need a reason for them to take down the bad guys when they'd been selling them up to that point as these sort of just only in it for the money mercenaries.
I do think it is one of the weaker parts of in the film. And I watched this actually a couple of times in preparation for it. And the first time I watched it, it did really bother me and jar me. But actually the second time around I watched it, it did bother me a little bit less. So I think it's one of those things that you do bump on it. It is a bit of a weakness, but this is genre entertainment, and you can, I think you sort of grade a bit on the curve, and I kind of have a certain sort of like three strikes and you're out sort of policy. And that is definitely one strike against the film, but it doesn't hit that critical threshold where I say, oh, that's it, forget it. I'm out of here with this movie. So I think it does survive a bit of weak writing around that part.
And that's, I think, where I have, and it leading that goes into that issue is something where the budget comes in, and I think probably is a drag against this movie, is they're sent to this village to sort of protect it and help it lead this rebel uprising. And I never get the sense that there's more than like 20 extras. Yes. When they're training guys, there's this great montage where they're training montages, and it never looks like in any of the crowds there's more than 6 to 8 soldiers. And you're thinking, okay, maybe these are different guys in each one. There's an army of 30. And we get into a great action set piece before this sudden change where more guys, more rebels are killed than I had seen in the film up until that point. And I think, I mean, again, I'm not Jake and Frenchy, but I don't have that their courage. But at that point, I'd been like, okay, everybody's dead. I'm getting out of here. This is I can't continue with this.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the entire sort of revolutionary force, fits at one point in the film on a very small school bus. And, you know, I have no military training, but I would say if this is the soldiers I have at my disposal to take over an entire country, I don't really fancy my odds. I'm happy to train you, but I'm taking no part in the overthrow whatsoever.
Especially after the just how much comedy there is in the montages about how bad these soldiers are there. It's just your Bad News Bears, your misfits sports movie type level of talent there.
So I think what we can conclude from that is that that you and I would have been picking up that bag of money thrown at us by Charles Martin Smith, and we'd have been taking those plane tickets and getting the hell out of Tengara as quickly as possible. Now this is a canon film, as I say, that a lot of their output was from the 80s was synonymous with action, and here we have a film about a couple of mercenaries trying to lead a revolution. So obviously there's going to be an action quotient here. Did the film deliver on that front for you?
In places there are some great action. There's specifically one in the middle that I'm sure we're going to get to soon when we talk about helicopters. But I think the action is it's pretty excellent there and pretty exciting. But then there are points where, again, there's this big finale where it just doesn't it doesn't pay off. You can tell that they're sort of shooting in just a couple locations. You get the sort of fun, something that's it's a fun part, like a trope of the genre where you get them walking in slow motion and just sort of spraying guns where they're not even looking, and just people falling off of everything, guys dropping off of vehicles, explosions everywhere, and just somehow the two guys aren't getting shot. At that point, like, something like that is both silly, but also that's part of the reason why you watch these these movies. But there are points where the budget, really just a little bit more money could have helped them, especially the finale, which I do feel is kind of a letdown. But then you see I think there's a great kind of very shocking, well done opening. And again, we have our central action piece in the middle, which sort of like props up the entire film, which helicopters, an entire rebel uprising getting destroyed. Yeah. Having the worst day.
Okay, I think we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be looking at the exploding helicopter action.
Oh, why tell him to freeze? He never freeze.
He should have froze.
It's not like we didn't tell him, right?
Nick and Frank are special cops doing a dirty job. They made their reputations the hard way. They earned them with style.
I ain't afraid of no jive cop.
Finesse.
I am not your normal cop.
And determination.
People told us you like to talk when you get high. Are we high enough yet, Bobby?
I'm gonna throw up!
Technically, you'll be throwing down.
There's a new mob moving into the city.
Pull over to the side of the road and freeze!
I told you, don't say freeze. It only kicks him off.
They're after the man at the top.
You haven't got a shred of evidence to prove he even kicks his dog.
And the higher they get...
You a dead man, Berserk!
The harder the climb.
And the homicide hit parade? You are number one with a bullet!
Number one with a bullet. Starring Robert Carradine, Billy Dee Williams, and Valerie Bertinelli. Number one with a bullet.
We're back, and now we are looking at the exploding helicopter action. This occurs after the CIA tip-off General Basavi as to the location of the rebel forces. He sends in three helicopters to wipe out the revolutionaries. The first helicopter is an Alouette III. It's dispatched by Robert Hayes using a grenade launcher on his machine gun. The second, which is another Alouette helicopter, is hit by gunfire and disappears behind a hill before crashing and presumably exploding. The third exploding helicopter is the best of the bunch, for my money anyway. You know, thinking that they've now subdued the enemy, the helicopter comes into land so that the ground troops that are on board can get out. However, spotting an opportunity, one of the rebels jumps on board the bus that they've been traveling on and drives it straight at the chopper, which is a Sea King S-61, I think. A machine gunner on the copter sprays the bus with bullets, killing the rebel. But in her last dying efforts, they're enough to make sure that the vehicle crashes into the aircraft, causing it to explode spectacularly. So, Austin, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action here?
Well, we'll go through them in order. I mean, the first one's your pretty standard exploding helicopter. The second one, so it's interesting. I first sat down after we talked about discussing this film together, and I watched this, and I thought, Oh boy, does this count? Does this second one count? And I was like, yeah, because that one, they kind of leave it open ended. You don't see it explode. you kind of assume, because it never comes back again, you kind of hear a rumbling noise, but it almost, I wonder if they had meant to insert a 2 second, 1 second shot of a miniature exploding, or, you know, an explosion going off. But it seems, I don't know, the second one is very disappointing, because we should have at least seen an explosion, like, even if they just had a, you know,
even if there's just like a plume of smoke or something coming up from that hillside. I think I had this film down as three exploding helicopters, but I think on these rewatches that I've done for this, I think I may need to knock this film down to two, because we can tell from we don't see anything, but we can tell from the sound that this helicopter has clearly crashed. But has it exploded? There's no noise. There's not enough noise to suggest that it has exploded. And as I said, there isn't that plume of smoke. So I think I might have to downgrade this film from having three exploding helicopters to two. So, I mean, you happy for me to knock one off?
I think the other solution would be an asterisk, but if you don't want to do that, it's just such a letdown, because you have the helicopter there, you have it flying behind. All it would have taken is one more shot to give us the satisfaction of this helicopter meeting its demise.
And they've done actually a very good job with that first one, because I think they've clearly got they're using a real helicopter, but then for the explosion they cut to what looks to me like a model that they've created, which they then blur apart. But actually the marriage of those of the footage is actually very, very well done, and it, given that the quality of that one, you kind of, as you say, yeah, it's a bit frustrating and a bit strange that they didn't give us a little bit more with that second one. But let's move to one which I'm sure you enjoyed, which is the third exploding helicopter, the one that's rammed by the bus. What did you make of that one?
Oh, I love that moment. That's one of my favorite moments in the entire film. I mean, other than beyond just the novelty of helicopter getting exploded by a bus, the rebel who is driving the bus gets just an extremely cool kind of way send off. And just not only because this rebel takes the bullets, she sort of falls. You think she's done for. You think they're all in trouble. There's all these soldiers swarming around this helicopter and inside of it. And yet, as she falls with the bullets, she's down on the floor of the bus, pushing the gasoline with her hand, the gas pedal. And if you're going to kill off a character who you've gotten the audience to invest in up until that point, you at least do it in a way that is that cool.
Yeah, it's a great send-off for that character because they're doing something really important in terms of whether this revolution is going to succeed or fail. She really sort of saves the day. The way in which this exploding helicopter executed again, it's very good. They've got a real seeking helicopter there, but they then, in terms of the, you know, there's a bit of editing to sort of cheat the scene, and they then blow up what they've clearly built a replica helicopter, which is what they then use to ultimately blow up. But again, the way in which the scene's put together, you know, only if you're an exploding helicopter fan and studying it, do you kind of, you know, you can see how they've done it. But how they've done it is very well and works brilliantly for my money.
It's a great, great moment. It's definitely one of those moments that if you're going to remember anything from 50-50 a long time after seeing it, it's probably going to be that particular method of destroying a helicopter.
Well, I think that probably just about wraps things up for this show. Austin, do you want to tell people a bit about your book, you know, and where they can find you online?
Sure. My book is The Canon Film Guide, Volume 1. It covers 1980 through 1984. Those are the years that after Canon had been acquired by Golden Globus and sort of their rise to power in the mid-80s. The second volume is actually coming later this year, looking like a springtime release, which covers 85 through 87, which is only a period of 3 years, but a massive number of films. This is when Canon was trying their best to get a movie in the theaters almost every weekend. It's staggering how many movies they were producing at that time. And yeah, you can find out information about the books, but also just I really kind of love the social media aspect. I love using Twitter and Facebook as a way to continue to share things. I've got boxes and boxes and boxes of Canon materials, whether it's sales catalogs, posters, lobby cards, just all sorts of things. And obviously stuff can't fit into a book. So I use Twitter and Facebook as a way to continue to share those things that I can't fit in the almost 1,500 pages that are in the first two volumes of the Canon Film Guide. So, yes, please. I'm at Canon Film Guide on both Twitter and Facebook.
Excellent. As always, don't forget to check out the Exploding Helicopter website for more reviews, facts, and stats on films where helicopters explode. We'll be back soon. But until then, keep watching the skies for those exploding helicopters.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
So that's that. What's it all add up to, Frenchie?
What's what all add up to?
48 men in Afghanistan.
Hey, we made a deal. We're going to forget about Afghanistan.
Now another 23. 71 men. One woman.